Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 24th, 2025, we're delighted to host a litigation update on CERAMAE versus Slack. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Peggy Little, who is a senior counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. She came to NCLA with over three decades of experience as a trial and appellate litigator, representing individuals and high-profile litigants, including Fortune 50 companies, financial institutions, public companies, and universities in state and federal court, including before the United States Supreme Court. Ms. Little has participated in many national conferences and symposia addressing issues of current importance in constitutional law, specifically state and federal constitutional questions regarding the separation of powers and the First Amendment, and she regularly speaks, blogs, and publishes on the topic of the unconstitutional exercise of governmental power. Her work has been published by Law Reviews, Legal Publications, The Wall Street Journal, Law and Liberty, and the Manhattan Institute. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Professor Josh Blackman, who has served as a professor at the South Texas College of Law in Houston since 2012, where he also holds the Centennial Chair of Constitutional Law. Additionally, Professor Blackman serves as an adjunct scholar with the Cato Institute. He has authored three books, the latest of which is An Introduction to Constitutional Law, as well as written more than five dozen law review articles that have been cited in nearly 1,000 times. He's testified before Congress and advises federal and state lawmakers and regularly appears on TV, including NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and the BBC. Professor Blackman is also a frequent guest on NPR and other syndicated radio programs, and he has published commentaries in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and other leading national publications. And I will leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, luckily found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when you get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Professor Blackman, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. ABA Model Rule 8.4G has been with us for a very long time, I think going on maybe 7 or 8 years. And it seems like there's been never any litigation about whether this rule violates the free exercise clause, whether it violates the free speech clause. And there have been several court rulings about 8.4G, but none have gone quite so far as CERAMAE v. Slack, as the case is now called. This is a challenge to a variant of Rule 8.4G adopted in the state of Connecticut. I'm very happy today, Peggy Little, my dear friend, will be talking about the challenge to this rule. Peggy, let's just start at the beginning. For those who maybe don't know, what is Rule 8.4G and why has it been so controversial the last, 7 years or so?
Well, the ABA proposed a new Rule 8.4G, as you mentioned, several years ago, and it was controversial from the beginning. And that is because it sought to regulate attorney speech in a number of new ways. And a lot of folks were concerned about that because most states tend to rather automatically follow the ABA rules of professional conduct. So the fact that this was proposed nationally drew a lot of attention. What is interesting about this rule is that a number of states, and I used to have the count, I think it's over a dozen, either their state AGs decided that it was unconstitutional or internally within the bar approval mechanism, those states declined to adopt it. And it has been slowly gaining some adoption in other states, mostly in the Northeast. It was certainly adopted in Pennsylvania, although in a less offensive form, and that led to some very fine litigation that was handled by Ted Frank's group, the Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute, and that was in Pennsylvania. Connecticut also adopted what I think is a more offensive version of the rule, and now New York State and Illinois are in the process of adopting it, and we just filed comments in the District of Columbia, which is also in the process of adopting this rule. And if there's one message I would like to lead with at the outset, and I may even close with this, is it's very important to pay attention to these rules. They look like minor changes, but in fact, they're quite consequential, and they're consequential for attorneys, not just in their ability to practice law, although it definitely impairs that as well, but also, you know, their ability to protect their reputation and even their law licenses. So this is not something to just pass over as a technical change in the rule. It is not. It's very substantive. Eugene Volokh was one of the first people to take note of this, and he has a very interesting video out there readily available about how this really comes down to a lawyer's speech code.
Let's start there. So 8.4G was very controversial when it was adopted. And indeed, as you said, many state attorneys general did not favor. In fact, they said it was unconstitutional. Many other states, even places like California, rejected it. Some states adopted with variations like New York and otherwise. Some of those variations actually cured the remedies. But I want to focus here on two states in particular, Pennsylvania, which you mentioned, and Connecticut. And maybe you can walk through what happened in Pennsylvania, because that's, I think, a good precursor to what happened to your case in Connecticut.
Well, Pennsylvania adopted a version of Rule 8.4, but that had been proposed by the ABA. But what it adopted was indeed less offensive. For one thing, it kept a scienter requirement. So you had to knowingly engage in harassment or discrimination. And it had other significant differences. But when the Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute took it into federal court, the district judge held A, that the attorney challenging it had standing, and B, that the rule like...
Just pause you. What's the challenge of bringing a suit against 8.4G? In other words, there's been no enforcement actions. So why has it been so difficult for plaintiffs to sort of challenge this rule with the absence of an enforcement action?
Well, it's a pre-enforcement challenge, and so you know, standing will come into play, and there are any number of reasons to try to challenge it promptly, because challenging it after it has been attempted to be enforced, right there inflicts reputational and other damage. And so in both the Third Circuit activity by the Greenberg plaintiff, and then also in Connecticut, we brought pre-enforcement challenges that were brought quite promptly after the state had adopted the rule. And
okay, I'm sorry.
So in Connecticut, the rule is, I think, in its most offensive form that it, where it has been litigated, and what it does, as opposed to the rule that had preceded it, which is Rule 8.4, subsection 4. That had a provision that did prohibit attorneys from engaging in discrimination, but they had to knowingly engage in that kind of discrimination. It also broadened the scope of its enforcement beyond the practice of law into even bar activities or teaching or public speaking, so that it reached attorney speech that went way beyond what was encompassed by the practice of law. And there's a very good question as to whether the rules of professional conduct can even reach that activity. It newly installed 15 protected classes. Now, the old rule had involved just discrimination, which would be read to understood to cover what is unlawful discrimination, and that would be by race or sex or the various things that are already covered by law. Here, the rule reaches gender identity, religion, all sorts of new classifications that are protected. And that's a dangerous expansion of the rule. These are some of the most controversial areas in our public discussion today.
Could you give an example, and I know this is in the complaints, of what your plaintiffs would want to talk about, but they're not able to talk about due to this rule. Maybe an example or two.
Yeah, sure. In our complaint, we have two attorneys that we represent. Timothy Moynihan is very vocal about critical race theory and the fact that it is being adopted in Connecticut schools. He speaks publicly about that. He is concerned with the assumption that we operate from a white supremacist background in our teaching. He's very vocal that this kind of curriculum, in fact, creates divisions, bring us together socially and culturally in a way that he thinks is very desirable. And Mario Cerami is a First Amendment lawyer himself, and he represents a number of criminal defendants. And in preparing them for trial, for example, he is often called upon to discuss how testimony might go, and that might include using forbidden language such as the N-word or other words that get shortened because they're just unsayable. And that makes it difficult for him both to represent his clients, but also to teach and talk about what is entailed in representing clients, whether it be in a bar activity or teaching adjunct, et cetera. He's also very critical of certain religious practice. He's outspoken that he thinks that Scientology is not a real religion, and very very clearly someone could bring him up on charges for expressing that opinion. And that's not prohibited discrimination under any laws that I'm aware of, but it is something that could bring his license to practice law into question.
So I know that, you know, Connecticut defends these challenges on the ground of standing. That is, this rule has been enforced, your plaintiffs have been injured. But I want to talk about the merits for a bit. How does the government defend the enforcement of this rule, especially in light of the free speech concerns here? Let's just try and get both sides, because we, you and I agree on this issue. But let's try to be fair here. And what is the best defense the government offers in support of their rule?
Well, the one that they open with, I assume it's their the one they think is best, is there is a provision in the commentary to the rule that says that the rule does not cover speech that is protected by the First Amendment. This is what is known in the opinion at the Second Circuit and also in the briefing as the carve-out. And Pennsylvania also had a similar carve-out protection that, I call it the just trust us exception, where, cleverly they are, in fact, regulating both content and viewpoint of speech, but they say, well, we won't prosecute anyone if the speech is otherwise protected by the First Amendment. And the problem with those carve-outs is they are ineffective because they are very vague in what they might cover. They do not, yes, it might end up protecting First Amendment protected speech, but that would be only after charges were brought, because what this rule enables is that for clients or anyone else interested in the speech of the offending lawyer can do is bring them up on charges saying, he insulted my religion, Scientology. I'm going to bring the charge against him. And yes, ultimately that may be found to be protected speech, but he or she has to go through a full enforcement process, damages to their reputation, to their time, and their resources to defend against those. And our view is that the rule should not be set up to allow this kind of wide-ranging and unlimited content and viewpoint discriminating speech that is also very vague.
Right. So that's the speech angle. Let's talk about religion for a bit, because a lot of people in religious communities are very concerned about it, Rule 8.4 and its variants. What are some of the arguments both for and against the free exercise or RFRA argument, why this rule might be a violation of religious liberty?
Well, because it does. I think that, for example, someone who would want to make a religious argument on gender or even gay marriage provisions. If they are out there saying that they don't think that the state should recognize gay marriage, et cetera, they could be brought up on charges. So and that is not permitted by the First Amendment and or the free exercise of our religion. So the rule not only prevents people from criticizing religion, but prevents people from the exercise of their speech in support of what their religious beliefs are in a way that could put into question their professional license.
Okay. But let's now move on to sort of the jurisdictional issues. At least in the Pennsylvania case, as I recall, the trial judge found that there was standing to bring this pre-enforcement suit. And then sort of on appeal, as I remember, Pennsylvania sort of modified the rule to get rid of the challenge. If that's what I remember what happened. They sort of modified the rules. Is my memory right in that one?
You're right. They, rather than appeal, they just modified the rule. And then a second challenge was brought. Mm-hmm.
So with yours, you lost at the trial court. On appeal, the Second Circuit found that there was standing. Where is the case now? What's sort of the latest with this case?
Well, the mandate has not even been issued to the district court. So we are at the point of resuming the district court proceedings. And the last sentence of the Second Circuit opinion said the court would address an 11th Amendment claim that had been brought by the state of Connecticut that had not been ruled upon by the district judge. And so they've remanded it with orders to the district judge to address the 11th Amendment claim.
Do you think that Connecticut will try to rewrite the rule and avoid what I think are glaring constitutional problems?
Well, one would hope so, and but I think not. And here's where the hope part comes. We initially sued two attorneys, Michael Bowler and Matthew Berger. And I know Matthew personally because I practiced law in Connecticut for most of my career. And both of them submitted comments saying that they found the rule was constitutionally charged, I think is what was the term that they use. And they also pointed out the vagueness, the lack of definition of harassment and discrimination. And so they were vocal commenters as to what they saw would be the problems with the rule. And I think that should have weighed very heavily mm-hmm. with the group that adopted the rule, because they are the two officials in Connecticut charged with enforcing the rules. But instead, even though they submitted these comments, which very much support mm-hmm. the claims that we are bringing in this case, the Connecticut Superior Court judges adopted the rule without any change and paid no heed to the comments submitted by the very people who would be in charge of enforcing the rule.
Okay, very good. Now let's sort of just pivot forward. What do you think, how do you sort of place Rule 8.4G in the sort of current anti-DEI moment we're in? I think, you know, over the last decade, there's been this sort of trend towards using the power of the government to perhaps suppress or punish ideas that are unpopular. And then President Trump, for better or worse, has, I think, kind of stemmed that tide. We're seeing corporations drop their DEI mandates. We're seeing the American Bar Association dropping their DEI mandate for law schools. We're seeing the ABA basically being shut out of federal government, you know, the new FTC order that members can't be part of the ABA. Do you think that entities like the ABA might take a hint that the sort of fixation on equity and inclusion at the risk of violating free speech? I mean, will there be any change? Never mind, 8.4G is a bad idea, or will they just fight this to the end of the time?
Well, it's hard to predict. I don't know of any impetus or effort being made to do that. Moreover, in Connecticut, the rules of professional conduct are adopted by the Superior Court judges, the state court judges. Mm-hmm. And so having done that by apparently unanimous vote, it was a voice vote, but there didn't appear to be any nays. I don't know that the judges of the Superior Court in the state of Connecticut are willing to dial back on that. I certainly have not heard of any effort made on their part to do so. And so I do think the rule will remain unchanged. I would be delighted if there was an attempt at rolling it back, because I do think that would be the most sensible way of resolving this. But another reason why I think litigation here is important, and we're glad to be successful. And by the way, I do want to give credit to my colleague, Richard Samp. This was his case. He brought it. He argued it. And I'm very much stepping into his very hard to fill shoes in talking about the case today. But he retired. And so I'm carrying the case on for that. But the reason why litigation is important is, as you say, these DEI things, they ebb and flow. They were, you know, hugely, even just a couple of years ago, hugely popular, and now there's a pullback. But the good thing about a court decision is that lasts. That's permanent. So even if the judges were to get together and say, you know, this isn't such a good idea, we'll go back to the old rule, in 5 years, DEI may be all the rage again, and it will get readopted, whereas a court ruling, I think, will have much more lasting effect and prevent this sort of rule.
Let me ask you another question. I mean, litigation comes from private litigants. Litigation also comes from DOJ and the federal government. Is there any opportunity for the Trump administration to sort of intervene on these bars? And many of these bars are what are called integrated bars. In other words, you have to be a member of the bar to be a practicing lawyer. Is there any ground for the federal government to sort of intervene in these unconstitutional mandates on government speech?
Well, certainly it could do so in an advisory capacity. Connecticut is not an integrated bar. And one of the reasons we think the 11th Amendment challenge is not well-founded here is that if it is really true that this question could only be addressed in the state courts, since it was all of the state Superior Court judges that adopted this rule, it would never be subject to any kind of court challenge, which is not where we should be in terms of regulation of attorney speech. So we do not think their 11th Amendment argument is very strong, but for those same reasons, because Connecticut's not an integrated bar and that the judges themselves put this in place, federal court is really our only avenue of review.
All right. I think I've asked all my questions. I want to go to Q&A. We don't have to take the full hour. Is there anything else that anyone would want to add, Peggy, before you go to the Q&A?
Well, I do want to point out that this is content and viewpoint discriminating speech. And that very much comes from adding all of these additional classifications about gender identity, et cetera. And these are very important areas for us to be talking about and for attorneys to be silenced or put at risk of losing their license is a very severe curtailment upon our freedom to talk about these issues, which are the pressing issues of our day. So my message is to pay attention to the rules in your state.
All right. So if we can maybe take some questions now from the audience. Let's see. Any questions from those?
Okay, there is a statement from someone, Josh, that your microphone needs to be turned up.
Well, that's the best I can do. So I'll have to talk louder. What other questions we have? I'll ask a question if no one else will. How do you respond to the argument that 8.4G is actually needed to promote civility? That this is basically a rule that conservatives hate because they want to say things that are harmful, and that the bar has a standard of decency to sort of promote civility in the bar. How do you respond to that argument?
Civility is important and a very valued aspect of how attorneys should conduct themselves. And I think very much the old rule did provide that when you're engaged in the practice of law, you could not engage in discrimination. And that took care of a lot of what I think people are concerned about. The problem with the rule is that it removes scienter. So, for example, if you were to misgender someone, even not knowing that this would they would take offense, you could subject yourself to charges of unprofessional conduct. It broadens the scope beyond the practice of law. So if you were to engage in a debate at a bar meeting or in the course of law teaching about, whether persons born as males should participate in girls' sports, you could, again, be charged with being violating the rules of professional conduct. The list of the 15 classes is so broad ranging that, and it would also reach free exercise of religion in your discussions. So I think that's the concern. As far as civility, there really hasn't been a civility argument made either in our case or in the Greenberg case in the Third Circuit. There was an argument made in support of the Connecticut rule where one of the proponents of the change in Connecticut said that when she was advocating for Black Lives Matter, she was called a race pandering nitwit. That was one of the motivating events behind the rule change. And, you know, as unfortunate as it is, that is protected speech. We are able to say things like that without putting at risk our licenses. I think it's unfortunate. It's something I would never do. But I also don't think it's speech that should rise to the level of taking someone's law license away from them. And that people need the ability to speak with some degree of fervor and conviction about these matters, and that sometimes protected speech is not attractive speech, but that's not the standard under the First Amendment.
Okay, let me ask a question that's in the chat. Harassment, right? This is an issue people often discuss. Is harassment protected speech? Is it not? And if the sort of the speech being engaged in is considered harassment, wouldn't that eliminate the First Amendment claim?
Well, that's a vagueness problem, and that's how we have briefed it, because the comment to the rule talks about harassment and discrimination as severe or pervasive, and harassment, but it doesn't really get into the distinction between conduct and speech. So it's very vague, and that's one of our grave concerns about the new provision. And that's, again, the two individuals who we originally sued, Attorney Bowler and Attorney Berger, made exactly that point in their comments, that it was just simply too vague. Sexual harassment, for example, or creating a hostile working environment is already addressable by existing law. And so that the rules of professional conduct, I think, to the extent that harassment could be properly reached, would be duplicative of what the law already provides.
Okay. Another question, how does the 11th Amendment interfere with the free speech 14th Amendment violation? Is there some sort of immunity, qualified immunity? In other words, where's the 11th Amendment actually come into this argument?
Well, we're puzzled by that, too. We don't think it's meritorious because we haven't sued the state. We have sued two state officials who are in charge of enforcing the unconstitutional provision, and that has long been recognized as a legitimate approach to dealing with unconstitutional regulations by administrative officials. So we do not think that is an argument upon which the state will prevail. Ex parte Young is very clear about that. And I think it's just, probably a little bit of a Hail Mary pass order to see if there's some sort of immunity that can attach. We don't see a good grounds for that.
All right, another question from the chat. Has any state actually taken an enforcement action under 8.4G or variant adopted in a state?
Well, one example came up. This is in Maryland, and it is very disturbing. Apparently two attorneys were exchanging a joke that could be considered both racist and sexist, and I don't even know what the joke was, but they were privately exchanging this on an email. Somehow it came to the attention of the bar officials, and they in fact were suspended for a period of time. And again, this was not something that they had said publicly or shared with clients or in any aspect pertaining to their practice of law, but nonetheless, they were suspended. So yes, this does have, there are concerns about enforcement reaching into private exchange.
Did Maryland adopt 8.4G, or this is just in theory, it could have been brought under an 8.4G regime?
I believe Maryland had adopted it, but I'd have to go back and look at the case. But it was certainly cited in our papers as something that was troubling because, I don't like those jokes. I don't enjoy them, but I also don't think that people should lose their law licenses for privately exchanging those jokes.
All right. Another question. Someone writes, the practice of law is a privilege, and the state may regulate and limit your ability to practice law. Lots of attorney speech is regulated. Why is this an instance where the state's regulatory power for an attorney speech does not permit it?
Okay, let me go to the questions because
I'm paraphrasing because you probably won't find this one. I paraphrased it.
Okay. The states have more flexibility to regulate than the federal government would?
No. Not about safer federal. Okay. The practice of law is a privilege and lots of attorney speech is regulated. So why can't this fall under the umbrella of a regulated speech of an attorney?
I think, and we've made this point in our papers, that attorneys enjoy the same freedom of speech as anybody else. There are things they can and cannot do in court in the practice of law, including untruthful speech or lying to the court about, what a precedent holds. And there are existing sanctions for doing that sort of thing. But in terms of their speech outside the courtroom or in bar activities, they do not surrender, any aspect of their freedom of speech shared with everyone just because they're attorneys.
Okay. So a ruling in this case would at most only affect Connecticut. Are there other challenges, other states you're planning to bring to challenge this rule?
Well, we are interested. We filed comments in the D.C. Case. The comments closed, I think it was just a few weeks ago, and we submitted comments urging the D.C. Bar not to adopt the rules. So, yeah, we are keeping track of this. I think that people who are watching this program should also keep an eye on their state bar officials to make sure that they are not finding their own ability to speak curtailed by the bar association.
Okay. A lot of good questions. What do we do with the fact that the Supreme Court has upheld in a Zouderer case, limits an attorney advertising otherwise? In other words, how does the argument you make now fit with these broader restrictions on attorneys, like advertising, for example?
Well, I think that nothing in the rule is directed to commercial speech and advertising. So I just think those are two separate areas of First Amendment expression. To the extent that Zouderer permits regulation of attorney speech in terms of what the attorney is capable of doing or specializes in and all of that. That's more of a truth in advertising kind of thing. Whereas here we're talking about content and viewpoint discrimination based upon 15 separate categories. And that just does not fit into the Zouderer world.
Okay, a couple of people asked about the DC proposal, which I've not actually studied, but DC added language in its rule that the speech must be directed at a person. In other words, it's not enough to be harassment or harassing speech, it has to be directed at a person. Does this make a difference whether about its constitutionality?
I don't think it does, but it may affect how the case comes up, because a person might take umbrage if it was directed at them as opposed to directed at an issue. And so I think it is more of a stylistic kind of thing. And also, you know, when we talk about microaggressions, for example, that's a good example of where a person taking offense at a statement that may be meant to be harmless, if to the extent that it talks about a speech directed to a person, it would reach those kinds of microaggressions, but maybe not the larger issues of debating the pros and cons of, say, gay marriage or gender identity.
A related question involves DEI training. So a number of states actually have CLE requirements, and some states actually have so-called diversity requirements. And arguably, these classes make you sort of engage in speech you don't want to hear. And in some cases, CRT might itself be discriminatory. How does your argument fit with the sort of the mandatory DEI trainings that attorneys sometimes have to sit through?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I think that the mandatory training does have some constitutional problems, including has been a sanction that has been levied upon people who have been expressing content or viewpoint that is not approved by the bar authorities. And I think it is constitutionally troubling for them to have to undergo that sort of training.
All right. Does this rule damage a client's ability to find an attorney that's willing to defend perhaps unpopular opinions?
I think that, yes, that is true, because, you know, the bar is, especially in a state like Connecticut, it's very small. And I have heard not just from the attorneys that we represent, but from others who have been discussing this rule with us, that they feel that, for example, if they're representing someone on one of these charged kinds of issues, their ability then to speak on behalf of their client publicly is chilled. And that is the standard for standing, has the rule been promulgated in a way that will chill speech. And the reports I'm getting from the professional bar in Connecticut is, yes, it does chill, not only in taking cases, but also in effectively defending them.
Mm-hmm. Is there any immunity issues where the judges who adopted it, do they have absolute immunity?
Well, I think...
In other words, instead of just sovereign immunity, is it maybe absolute immunity that you're suing judges?
Well, no, we're not suing judges and we're not suing the state. We're suing the officials that enforce the rule.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah. So we're not telling the judges what they can do, but we are suing the officials saying they cannot enforce a rule that is this unconstitutional.
I think I've made my way through most of the questions, and some of them are a little bit repetitive. Maybe I'll give you a chance for some closing thoughts.
Well, my closing thoughts are, this has been an eye-opener for me in terms of seeing the activities of a bar, which is supposed to be out there to defend unpopular people and unpopular causes, and to protect things like religious liberties, to protect our civil liberties, and to see the very profession enact rules that curtail that ability and put the lawyers themselves at risk of at least reputational damage, if not the actual loss or suspension of their license to practice law, is a deeply troubling development. I think it's all part of this much more widespread censorship problem. And we hope to prevail in this litigation because, as I say, a lasting precedent that tells the bar officials in all the states that they need to be just as protective of attorneys' speech rights as anyone's speech rights in order to have an effective democracy that protects civil liberties is essential.
Excellent. All right. Well, I thank you all so much for your attention, and I'm appreciative to the Federal Society, and hope you all have a lovely day and good luck with litigation, Peggy.
Thank you so much, Josh.
I'll echo those thanks on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thank you to you both for sending this portion of your afternoons and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.